Modern democracy runs on a paradox. We vote for politicians, but a huge amount of real power sits with people we never elected. Central bankers, regulators, judges, agencies, commissions, independent authorities. And, you know, sometimes that's obviously good. You know, it protects short-term political sugar highs from turning into long-term disasters. It makes complicated systems governable. And it lets the state do hard things that take longer than a single election cycle. But it also creates a question that's getting harder to dodge. When does expertise stabilize democracy, and when does it quietly replace it? If major decisions are moved out of politics, what happens to accountability? What happens when voters can't tell whether a policy failed because it was a bad idea, or because some insulated institution implemented it badly, or because the public never really consented to the trade-offs in the first place? And then there's the twist. Technocracy often starts as an insurance policy, something a governing coalition builds because it worries it might lose power. But that same insulation can provoke the backlash that brings a different coalition to power, one that campaigns on smashing the whole apparatus. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together everyone from socialists to conservatives together in conversation over the most important issues of the day. Gabrielle Graton is a professor of politics and economics at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. His research on the causes of rising right-wing populism gets at the very heart of these questions. And his arguments are a bit uncomfortable for liberals because they implicate us in the rise of right-wing populism. This is one of my favorite conversations that I've had yet on this podcast, and I hope you enjoy it. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. So I am so excited to have you on because I'd come across a couple of your articles, and they were just so in line with a lot of the themes that I had been thinking about in my own work about democratic backsliding, about the rise of populism, and in particular, the role of elite behavior in driving incentives for voters to go towards populism or towards illiberalism in general. And so there's a lot in your papers, but I want to start at kind of a macro question. Across your papers, from illiberal democracies to Kafkaesque bureaucracies, there's a recurring theme of traps. You know, is that how you see our current moment, as like a set of bad equilibria that it's hard to escape from?
Interesting. I think that there is a recurrent theme of dynamics. There is a recurrent theme. So sometimes are traps, but sometimes these traps are cycles. I definitely see that things can be spiraling out of one equilibrium into some other steady state, some other equilibrium that we might not like. But this new equilibrium may also be inherently an equilibrium of cycles, right? So the world that we might be in right now may be a world that is going to more violently cycle between extremes of what we might call a more majoritarian or more populist view of democracy, a view of democracy whereby the government should do what the people want, and there is no other aspiration about protecting individual rights or minority rights or aspirations about social equality. And then, you know, swings from this reality to instead moments in which the forces that win elections are forces that have a view of democracy that is more liberal, in the sense that, you know, democracy should be not about just doing what the people want, or maybe not doing much at all what the people want, but instead it should be about protecting individual rights, protecting minority rights, developing institutions that can favor social mobility and fairness and equality. So I don't know if it's totally true that I see necessarily that it's a spiral into a trap forever. But you know, traps exist, and I have we have all witnessed traps. Traps can be also positive in a sense. But I also see the possibility of cycles in my work.
Yeah, I'd love to be trapped in liberal democracy. That's a good trap. Well, I wanted to ask you kind of at a broad level before we get into your work. Why do we see a rise of populism right now in so many Western liberal democracies? Why do you think that's happening?
This is a tough question to answer. I don't know if I have the whole answer for everybody. I think that there are a few key aspects that I think they're common to many theories, but perhaps we tend to favor one or the other depending on our own political side, what we want to favor. I think that one important aspect is that democracy is understood by a lot of the demos, a lot of the people, as delivering something for the people. Is government by the majority for the economic and social benefit of this majority. And there are vast part of the population in Western democracies that feel very much betrayed by what democracy has delivered. In the United States, this may be more easily identified with white males from outside the most major metropolitan areas. In other countries, this may be identified with somewhat different exact demographics. But there is a trend out there. That there are important parts of the population that were promised something. If you are a white American man in your 30s or 40s, you were promised that democracy would deliver the kind of economic environment whereby you would be a little bit better than your parents. You would afford a home. You would have a social, also a social,
status.
A status, right? So you would have a wife and your children and your dog and a garden to take care of. And now you are not being delivered those things. May not have a wife, may not have children, may not have your dog, may not have a proper home with a garden, which was what you were promised, that democracy meant that. You weren't told that democracy instead meant equality of rights for minorities, which, me and you may believe that it very much means this, but this is not what was in the mind of a lot of people. They were promised that democracy would also take care of minorities, would also help people in other countries sometimes with some foreign aid, but that by and large, democracy would deliver to you, regular Joe, the life that you were told that you would get. You will not get very rich. You will not, have a yacht, but you would have a wife, children, a dog, a garden. And a large part of this generation feels betrayed because they weren't delivered those things. And now what they do observe is that the intellectual elites, besides the rich elite, the intellectual elites that dominate our media, that dominate our universities, dominate our politics over the past two or three decades, did not debate very much about this problem. They seem to be focusing on other issues that vaguely get described as identity politics or foreign policy. Things that don't seem to relate immediately to the livelihood of, again, that regular Joe that wanted to have just a regular life. And so they feel, okay, this is something wrong. This is not the democracy I signed up for. Maybe democracy doesn't even mean what I thought it meant. Maybe democracy means the ruling of the intellectual elites. And the intellectual elites have all sorts of different views of the world, not necessarily because they are evil, they just may have different views of the world. If you are a bureaucrat in the federal administration, you have a different perspective of what to do in case of a recession because you're your likelihood to lose your job and lose your home is very different from those working in the factories in the American Midwest. And the same can be said about many other countries, of course. I'm focusing in the United States because I'm talking to you.
I appreciate it.
Welcome. This is an elite that we don't, I belong to this elite and I don't feel it on a daily basis. I don't feel I have tremendous power to, to change what governments do. But from the perspective of these voters, I do belong to this elite, and I'm there in a university telling students about how much it's beautiful to have a liberal democracy that cares about minorities, that improves the livelihood of people that have been, marginalized for decades or centuries, and they feel like this is not really the democracy that they signed up for.
I've been thinking a lot about this exact problem because many of the people who, like myself, and from your work, it seems you, are concerned about the fall of liberal democracy or the democratic backsliding that we're seeing, a lot of the pushback seems to have been in the form of trying to lecture the public about why liberalism or why liberal democracy is good, almost from first principles. Like, why should you care about due process? Why should you care about individual rights? And I don't even mean to malign the demos in saying that that is, and I don't think you do either, in saying that that's not like the primary reason why people supported liberal democracy in the first place, particularly from the American context. I mean, liberal democracy was pitched as, we're going to save the world from the Nazis and from fascism, and then we're going to save it from communism, and the scourge of communism will bring you bread lines, it'll bring you scarcity, it'll bring you poverty, whereas capitalism and liberal democracy, which were seen as almost synonymous, will bring you prosperity. And it's weird to me now to see that as many, many people are trying to defend liberal democracy, so few of them try to do it on the grounds of the original winning argument, which was about prosperity and economics and national security. Now, liberalism is often defended on the grounds of process and minority protections, which are things I care about, but I don't think those were the winning arguments. Those were just like side benefits.
That's very interesting. I think I agree with a lot of the things you said. I'm not sure that the historical root of liberal democracy, I completely agree. But maybe because you don't mean it in that sense. So I don't know. I don't. Now I'm gonna be the silly one that on the podcast tries to tell the history of Western democracy in 2 minutes and sounds like an idiot.
Do it.
Liberal democracy, the way that we know it, right? It's an uncomfortable marriage of two elements. One is the majoritarian aspect of democracy, that people are gonna vote and affect policymaking somehow, and institutions that limit the power of the majority to guarantee individual rights and guaranteeing collective minority rights. Now, some of these rights are instrumental to free and fair elections, say freedom of speech. Some of these rights are not instrumental to free and fair elections. They are things we like programmatically, including the protection of property rights, but also the protection of racial or gender or other minorities. Now, the way this arose, in my view, is mostly because the processes of democratizations were also compromises between existing elites that enfranchised in a way or in another, the majority, but kept some of the elements of policymaking outside the power of majority. This is one way to tell the story. It's not very different than the way that, also Acemoglu and Robinson, right? Mm-hmm. It's not very different, right? So they enfranchised the others, but we kept some elements. So some things are constitutionally forbidden to touch, including, for example, property, as I said, but also other minority rights. or other individual rights. Now, this partially, this project was successful, but only partially, because the rise of fascism and communism is, in some sense, a rise of popular movements that saw liberal democracy as incapable of delivering to the masses what the masses really needed. They represented this as a matter of class or as a matter of nation, but still, it was a message that liberal democracy is failing, is not giving the masses what the masses really need. We're going to have this other system that is more collective and is going to deliver. Now, liberal democracy triumphed, and you're right in this, it triumphed when it fought this alternatives. But perhaps it triumphed in a world in which the elites were also very scared of these alternatives. The elites of Western Europe and the United States were very scared of communism after the war, and they worked together with forms of collective actions, in particular, you know, trade unions, workers' unions, and so on. They worked together to somewhat sustain the post-war social democratic equilibrium in a more stable way. And perhaps the end of the Cold War also meant a moment in which part of the liberal elites felt less a threat from alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe we went too far. We were too sure of ourselves. We were too sure that liberalism was triumphing. So that's the historical, the way I see the historical side of the story. But you were also raising another point that I might have forgotten now, that besides history, you were saying that the way that us elites are trying to defend liberalism now is somewhat dogmatic, almost like the liberal constitution is right. Yes, but we also have another attitude, very present in the last years, of the science, the experts mm-hmm. are dominating the scene. So we are the experts, and we're going to tell you that this is good for the economy, this is good for society. Politicians should do what the experts say. Now, this was particularly obvious Exactly. This was particularly obvious during the pandemic period, but it's also obvious about, Trump is against free trade, or is pro tariffs, or whatever the exactly is he has in mind. But a lot of the relationship between politics and free trade in the 1990s and the first 15-20 years of this century has been an attitude of, well, the economists are right. This is the experts are telling us that this is right. And so, you know, politics should have almost no space in this. It to a level, the EU experiment has been an extreme of this, right? Governments have delegated to this supranational government, which is more detached from the popular ability to control it. The electoral accountability is more indirectly elected, as delegated to them all trade policies. But even in the United States, there has been an expansion of how much power is delegated to authorities that are independent from government. Obviously, central banks, obviously, environmental acts and regulation. But you know, there's an expansion of what the experts choose rather than what politicians choose. And politicians are accountable to voters, while experts are much more indirectly accountable to voters. And so the rhetoric is not just one of liberal democracy is dogmatically right, but it's also the experts say that this is the right things to do. But the experts often enough do not... You know, in the case of trade, it's pretty obvious that yes, this has increased the size of the pie, which is good, but the size of the pie is going to benefit everybody if we can distribute it in such a way. And mm-hmm. you know, I'm an economist by background, right? And you know, we often cite, you know, the welfare theorems. Now, the second welfare theorem is often cited by pro-market people, and it's a perfectly legitimate argument. And the second welfare theorem roughly says, look, if there exists a allocations of goods and services and things we like that is efficient, then there it can be reached with free markets as long as the initial distribution of endowments, wealth, talent, human capital is chosen accurately. And interestingly, Amartya Sen pointed out that this is used as a pro-capitalist or pro-market argument, but it's the most revolutionary argument ever because it says you should first redistribute all those things in order to achieve. Mm-hmm. So it's somewhat paradoxical. And so about free trade, the experts said the pie is going to be bigger and we can redistribute it. And by and large, we forgot to redistribute it. Not because of lack of attempts. I don't believe that this is because the elites are evil and they didn't try to do this right. I think the elites forgot how complex society is and how systemic risks can be, you know, can spread in society. We forgot it about systemic financial risk when in 2007, 2008, we got surprised by them. We forgot it about systemic social risks, like if we liberalize certain opioid drugs, this can create an entire new epidemic of a new problem that is going to affect exactly those sectors of the population that are going to be hit by the spikes of local unemployment due to the reallocation, the economic reallocation because of free trade.
You know, I often don't think of the story as being one of forgetting. I think of it as one of capture usually. So when it comes to trade, right, like we know, at least in the US context, like the China shock literature, which has been used pretty extensively to say that trade has been, you know, bad for certain groups. I mean, what it actually shows is that on net, the welfare of everyone was better off, including the people in, you know, Midwestern, white men, because of the reduction in prices that they were able to face. But the question is that are the technocrats, are the elites appropriately understanding the values of the public? Because they're like, it's like, it is true that like everyone is better off if you were to like show on a graph like people's welfare and map that out. But from someone's perspective about what we were talking about earlier around status, around, you know, losing your job in an industry that was important or meaningful to you, watching your community change, watching your status in society in culture, on TVs change, and watching your industry, particularly I think with climate, get demonized if you're working in an industry that's fossil reliant. I mean, those things, I think it was less of a forgetting and more of a miscalculation, misunderstanding. And I think on top of that too, people often didn't notice how captured a lot of these processes were by actors that were benefiting way more from the status quo. You know, for instance, I think with trade, you know, the benefits are not even close to equally distributed. So, you know, the people who are wanting to maintain it. But I think this like leads me directly into this tension, which you get at so well in your paper on technocracy and majoritarianism, which is, you know, the fact that there is a tension, in technocracy, which can be democratic, but there's a tension in technocracy about whether how democratic it really is in practice, even if theoretically it could be. So I first want you to define for us like what a technocracy is, but then also like why do technocracies or technocratic institutions tend towards anti-majoritarianism? Like that doesn't necessarily have to be true. You could be a technocrat who's like very attuned to majoritarianism, to what the populace wants, and then to weigh that against like science or expertise.
Yeah, yeah. Let me connect it to your point about the use of the word forgetting. I completely agree with you. Maybe I shouldn't say forgetting. What I meant by forgetting is we are trained to know that there are many more things other than, say, just economic well-being, that, or better, that economic well-being also includes your sense of status, your ability to fulfill your livelihood as a human being. As I said before, that the man wants to feel that he has a family and things like that, or that a woman wants to have a family, or there are many ways in which we realize ourselves. And so we are trained to do that. So the technocrats are people that are trained to try to take into account this multifaceted dimensions of economic well-being, but we are often tasked as technocrats do this cost-benefit analysis, right? When we say like, oh, the costs for society are bigger than the benefits, so we shouldn't do this policy, or the benefits are bigger, so we should do this policy. And ultimately, what we are trying to do in a way or in another is to take some sort of utilitarian approach. Now, this utilitarian approach may be more or less Rawlsian. We care more about the people in the worst circumstances, or is instead, purely Benthamite. And, we think of everybody the same. It's obviously a very hard thing to do. But inherently, this is not the same as doing what the majority wants. Because, we can make simple examples. Suppose that we have a majority that, to make an example that is, obvious for my generation, I'm an oldish millennial. So for an oldish millennial, we cared a lot about the right to marry of lesbian and gay and so on. So we wanted that. And we perceived, this was a situation definitely in the 1990s, that there was a majority that didn't want it in most Western countries. Now, this majority didn't want it, but how much did they really care about it? I mean, this was not something that affected their livelihood directly very much. So I don't know how much they cared about it, but let's call it one. Each of them wanted it by one. And then there was a minority of homosexuals that cared about it and they wanted to have these reforms, but they cared about it a lot. This was very important for them. I don't know how much. I don't know if they cared it 10 or 100, but obviously they cared about it much more individually than what the majority cared about it individually. And so if you are trying to measure the cost and benefits of introducing gay marriage, you would have to take into account each vote from an homosexual that wants to marry. You would have to take into account as a 100, and you should take into account each vote from a bigot, so to speak, that doesn't want gay marriage as a one. And this is cost benefit analysis. This is exactly what we are trained to do as economists or sociologists. And this is very different than majority voting. And so there is an inherent, tension between maximizing social welfare and voting on things. Mm-hmm. In a dynamic world, sometimes you are the majority and you want something. So, for example, you might be a majority today that wants to take care of the huge climate risks associated with global warming. So you say, okay, we need to do something here. And you will discover that if you ask most technocrats, most experts, most scientists, they side with you. And they say, yes, it's true. The cost of inaction are so big compared to the benefits of action that we should do action. Even if there are costs today, obviously, closing coal burning energy production will cost something today. But the benefits tomorrow are so big that we must do it. And so you are wondering what happens if I lose my status of majority. Because today I'm the majority, I can vote and I can get climate action. But tomorrow I may be the minority. And not only I will be the minority, but I will be the minority in the worst case scenario, that I am the minority, but I am the one that cares about it the most. I am exactly like the an homosexual in the 1990s. So I care about it the most. It's more important for me. Now, suppose I could create a new technocratic institution, an independent authority, similar to the Federal Reserve, an independent institution that, you know, can take care of climate policy, populated by experts and technocrats. I move away this decision from Congress, from the executive, a little bit. It's not possible to insulate it completely, but I can move it away so that it's harder to change policies. This can work as an insurance for me. So when the current majority is concerned that they might lose their status of majority, but they expect that their preferences are going to be reflected by the will of technocrats that have in mind these social welfare ideas, they may want to institute more independent authorities. And this will transform our democracy into what we call, with Jacob Edenhofer, a technocratic democracy. It is still a democracy because the new governments will have, the new majority will have the power through Congress in the United States to change things again and to delete these institutions, to drain the swamp of all these experts and return power to politics. But it is a technocratic democracy in the sense that for at least a little bit, decisions are taken by these experts. And I think that this is a lot of what we have observed, or we are observing, in Western democracies right now. There has been a movement by a coalition that governed in a way or in another between the early 1990s and, let's say, the middle of last decade, right? Because yes, there were elections, and obviously Bush is not the same as Clinton, and Obama is not the same as Bush, but by and large, there was a centrist, moderate, pro-trade, concerned about the emancipation of minorities, no child left behind, somewhat paternalistic in this sense, coalition that governed, and this coalition felt increasingly worried about losing power. Increasingly worried about losing power, and so try to move decisions away from politics. And this, because also this coalition was very much in agreement with the experts, with the science, with the economists. And so move away power from politics and move it to technocrats. Creation of independent central banks, creation of independent authorities for regulating many aspects of life, including climate change, the expansion of powers of the judiciary on many of these dimensions, which again is a way of taking it away from majority voting. And this naturally generates a reaction when then the new majoritarian coalition becomes one that doesn't want climate action, doesn't want wokeism, as they call it. And so this majority will want to drain the swamp of these independent authorities and dismantle this bureaucracy. And we have seen it very clearly with Trump 2.0 and Elon Musk. The first thing to do was dismantling the state bureaucracy that was there to implement these social welfare maximizing policies, perhaps, but not majoritarian policies.
You know, the story that you're telling, I think, can be very uncomfortable for liberal democracy and for liberal Democrats and for technocrats, because the story is one where liberal Democrats failed democracy first, and in reaction, populism, which, I mean, I don't think, like, you know, anyone is really, really defending the versions of, at least the versions of populism that are existing in a lot of these countries, particularly the US right now. But that populism is a democratic majoritarian backlash to the silencing of a great many legitimately democratic views, that were not able to have their viewpoints heard in the existing system. So the examples you give around, I mean, the one that seems like cleanest to me is around climate, where you have a elite consensus that builds around climate change being a serious problem, something that is true, something that even the population largely accepts, that this is a, it's a big issue, that there will be some harms, that it's largely human created. This is now, like, widely accepted, even by, in the United States, Trump voters, as being true. What is not accepted is that in order to deal with that problem, people today should take on economic, harms or pay anything really to remediate this problem. And that is not a viewpoint that was deemed acceptable by people who were pushing for climate action. And so the story that you're telling is really one where it's not clear to me who's on the side of democracy, because obviously we're now in a situation where the populists are trying to undermine even the ability of them to lose power, right? Like, you talk about this in your story that, like, you know, in another paper you write around how, you know, people might rationally choose, illiberalism because they are caring about their own economic security, but then the illiberal governments undermine the right or the ability of the people to choose differently in the future. So obviously I think that's what we're seeing right now in a great many countries. That's what the concern you see in, like, places like Orban's dictatorship, or in other countries too. But, you know, how do you think about this problem? Like, who's on the side of democracy here? Is nobody on the side of democracy?
No, I love your question. It sounds like I'm convincing you. whether
I'm concerned.
I'm convincing you of first one thing. Democracy is... We are way too focused on democracy, yes, democracy, no, and too little focus on democracy is a multifaceted thing and means quite different things in the minds of different people. I agree with you that the arguments that I'm putting forward are uncomfortable for many supporters of liberal democracy. But the key point for me is that I'm making this argument precisely because I really like liberal democracy. And I like liberal democracy more than I like the cost-benefit analysis that we discussed about before. And so I'm concerned for liberal democracy stability. And if you want, my argument is that for a reason or another, if we like liberal democracy, we can't make it too liberal. You cited the argument in the paper about illiberal democracies. And one of the key arguments in there is that it's precisely the fear that the liberal constraint on the power of the executive will make my executive, my government, unable to protect me that makes me want an illiberal leader. It's precisely because I'm scared of terrorists that I would like the government to be able to waterboard some of them. I don't want that. I don't like torture, but I'm scared. And if I'm sufficiently scared, I'm willing to abandon these liberal constraints and elect somebody that can waterboard terrorists. Or if I'm very scared of immigration, because I think immigrants are bringing more crime or they are taking my job, I'm willing to abandon my ideal that I want to be friendly with immigrants. And I want to elect somebody that instead is going to treat them very badly and therefore discourage immigration. So if we want to protect liberal democracy, we need a liberal democracy that doesn't constrain the actions of the government too much, that allows the government to respond to the need of the population, even when these needs are at the boundary of what we are morally comfortable with as liberal people. We have to accept that liberal democracy is a process, that maybe one day we'll be able to have more liberalism, that maybe one day we'll be able to avoid all the aspects that we find morally reproachable. But that at every single step, if we want to protect liberal democracy, we need to limit how much liberal we want to be. We need to give the powers to democratically elected politicians to be able to be responsive to these demands. And this is also true a little bit about media, or better. Obviously, I am very much against any limitation on the freedom of media to report. But it's also true that some of the aspects of what we are seeing in the past two decades is also the fact that these political elites have lost also control over the information. And so, we lived in, I'm from Italy, so it's a bit different than the US, but when I was a child, there were literally 6-7 TV channels. That was all the information. They were all controlled by a small elite of highly educated, well-spoken, much better spoken than I am, and individuals. There was no space for alternative views that we might call conspiracy theories or fear-mongering attitudes. Today, we live in a world in which it's very easy to influence. And so people that do not belong to this intellectual elite can have millions, hundreds of millions of followers. We are in a world in which the most viewed political TV show in the United States has an order of magnitude fewer viewers per week than Joe Rogan. Orders of magnitude. Right. And Joe Rogan does not come from this small intellectual elite that are very close to the governments and universities and so on. So this has changed. Governments have lost control of the informational environment. By losing control of the informational environments, there is going to be more often panic in the population. Panic that the immigrants are eating the cats and the dogs or whatever the hell Trump said that they're doing. Right? And now I'm scared. Now I'm scared of the immigrants and I want a government that is capable of doing something about it. And so you see that one of the implications, again, of our modeling about the rise of illiberal democracies is that when the informational environment becomes harder to control for the government, you need a government that has fewer liberal constraints. And so paradoxically, this new era of information technology is an era in which we can afford perhaps less liberalism, at least for the time being. But again, I am saying that we have to afford less liberalism because I want to save the liberalism we have, because otherwise we risk the alternative. And the alternative, as we talked about before, about the history of liberal democracy, the alternative is that new forms of collectivism, like fascism or communism, arise and win. And we are seeing that the young generations in the West today are believing less and less in liberal democracy as something that can in fact be the solution to whatever their problems, their needs, their aspirations are. And they are seeing in other models of society, say China, the answer. But I don't want that, because I think I am incredibly lucky historically to have, I grew up in a society in which I could freely aspire to develop, emancipate, flourish as a human being. And this is extremely rare in history. And we need to protect it. If unfortunately that comes at the cost of making it a little less good, maybe that's what we have to do.
So I understand what you mean by we need to protect the democracy part of liberal democracy more than the focus on the liberal part. So the impulse insulate...
Sorry if I interrupt you. That's not what I meant to say. I mean to say that we want to protect the liberal part. It's very important, the liberal part. But I'm saying, unfortunately, we can't push it to necessarily what we want all the time, because this can create backlashes, and the backlash can be so violent that we lose, what do you say? We throw the baby with the dirty water.
The bathwater, right?
So like, that's what I'm saying. I want to protect the liberal aspects, but I'm saying, unfortunately, there is going to be a constraint. There is like a total budget of liberalism that we can have before we cause such a backlash that then we just lose everything.
And can you, I think example might be helpful here, because I think that in your paper, you go through the a few different areas in which technocratic institutions have taken over. So what is kind of a way that people push the liberalism too far and maybe maxed out our budget?
Well, for example, in many parts of Europe, this both within the euro area, so Germany or Italy, and outside, think about the UK, we have institutionalized budget limitations or constitutionalized budget limitations. The government cannot have run a deficit greater than such and such, cannot accumulate more than such and such debt. This has de facto removed from the political debate, the majoritarian debate, the parliamentarian debates, a very important policy lever. And this has generated what we call the austerity period in the second decade of this century. And this austerity period has created big damages across many parts of the populations that are maybe, they're not perhaps identified like in the US by necessarily a gender, racial, and geographic position, but they're still similar. They are young people that aspire to have a relatively secure job in industry or service, not too dissimilar from the one that their parents had, and that suddenly had no opportunity, right? And so that has been a push of taking policy away from politics that had reasons, similar reasons to the reasons that we want independent central banks. We want independent central banks because we don't trust ourselves, if you want, the political process to take into account the dynamic implications of printing too much money to create inflation. And so we wanted to avoid situations that happened in countries such as Italy, in which for a couple of decades governments ran excessive deficits, and now the entire population has to find a way to pay with taxes the interest on these debts on every single year. So we wanted to avoid these things. There was perfect good reasons to do that. So economists said, well, one way we can do it is move fiscal policy away from the hands of politicians, because politicians need to respond to these gut feelings of the voters that get scared of losing their jobs. We economists can take care of the cost and benefits in the long run, and we will understand what's the right limit. But this has created so much backlash against democratic institutions, because it feels, for the average voter, it feels this thing that you guys are calling liberal democracy is failing me completely. Youth unemployment is 30%. That's you know, you were saying before that liberal democracy said we give prosperity, while look at the communist world doesn't have prosperity. If youth unemployment is 30%, what kind of prosperity is there? All I can hope is that I can inherit the apartment of my parents. That's not a future.
I think that. I mean, the austerity one is very resonant, because we just published at The Argument a piece by The Economist Oliver Kim about how austerity politics contributed to the rise of the Nazis in Germany, and that was a large factor above the inflation that's usually blamed. And you know, the thing though that I want to balance here, right? Because if we're talking about outcomes and how if people feel failed economically, they may turn to populism, there's kind of a balancing act here, right? Because the economists are right about central bank independence, right? Like if you had, you know, Donald Trump in control of the interest rates of the central bank of the United States of America, I think it's like way more likely you get either a recession or like hyperinflation. And in many cases, I mean, perhaps he's the most democratically legitimate actor to make that decision, because he was elected by popular vote in the most highly, in a highly inclusive election where people had a very clear understanding of both sides and made a decision. But like, is the idea that when people choose a democratic, elected official that gets them into a depression, that they will accurately understand and interpret that to be the result of, you know, the inflation rate that the interest rate that was set by the president 4 years ago? So like, I think the problem I'm having here is that like, it seems possible that you actually end up also undermining democracy in a world where you allow elected officials to make such terrible decisions that are good in the short term or good for some people, but end up like wrecking the entire economy, because that could also lead to 30% youth unemployment if you had central bank independence taken away in the United States.
I completely agree. It's a very difficult balancing act. Democracy in its purest majoritarian form will not be a very stable environment. That is not the absorbing state, as the people that work with dynamic models would talk about. This is not the end of the story, right? So a pure majoritarian democracy will not be a very stable, because it would suffer from its inherent intertemporal problems. If you want to think of the history of an economy governed by populists that wanted, perhaps frankly and honestly, wanted to do good things for the vast majority of the mass of workers, think of Argentina. Argentina is a country that went through a period of decades of push for a more, in a different sense than identity politics, in a sense of class politics, a more inclusive society. But this push for a more majoritarian democracy was very unstable. It's not that majoritarian democracy would be stable. So absolutely, there is a certain amount of technocracy, a certain amount of liberalism that is necessary for stability. And there is an amount of technocracy, an amount of liberalism that will cause backlash and instability. So I completely agree with you. There are also other, we're making it now a very econ story about being efficient, being good for, but there are moral issues, right? There are moral issues out there. The history of the United States is a history in which judicial decisions that were not necessarily majoritarian at the time had great impact on the development of the society. Civil rights, but also abortion rights, that now has been going backward. But some elements of the history of liberal democracy that we like, that we think are absolutely morally fundamental, right? Equality between races. We think of it as a non-negotiable thing. It's not like, to save liberal democracy, I will enslave 20% of the population. That is not a way to save any liberal democracy. So obviously, some elements of the of this liberal aspect of a democratic constitution, that certain things are not to discuss. Congress cannot vote on them. Doesn't matter what the voters say, are necessary for me and you to agree to this social pact. Definitely. Beyond even the question of economic efficiency. They're just a moral issue. All my argument is that we have to be careful, and we have to sometimes perhaps give some aspect of leeway, some constitutional flexibility, some powers to governments to act at the boundaries of what we find acceptable. And this is not like a completely new idea, even in law, right? I mean, it's not new, the idea that it's not okay that we have the Guantanamo Bay thing, but maybe we're going to close our eyes while it happens, just to see how it goes, right? This is something that is not, it's not totally new. This is something that we have been doing.
No.
Right? We haven't gone to the, we haven't revolted against the government. We just said, we don't like it. But.
Yeah. And I mean, in some ways, it is, I mean, one of the foundational liberal ideas is that there's no such thing as a permanent victory. And that in some respects, too, what you are arguing for is actually a doubling down on that liberal idea, and that this impulse when you're in power to try to enshrine your views, your preferences, your moral viewpoint into law, such that it cannot be undone when your team loses, is in some ways kind of a liberal too. Like, it's not actually that, you know, engaging with those core ideas. But one thing I wanted to ask you about, because I think this happens a lot in conversations about the rise of populism or about the rise of illiberalism, is we're talking about like vastly different countries in some respects. We're talking about countries as different from Hungary and Argentina to the United States to Germany to Italy to, I mean, these are countries with very different institutional designs, very different demographics, very different sometimes issue area focuses. How is it the case that there is such commonality in the decisions and viewpoints of the elite in these spaces, such that it led to kind of similar populist backlash at similar times? Because one would expect, if it was a question of strategic decision making in a few core areas, like obviously in the European story you told, kind of most of Europe all kind of went together in one boat. But, you know, it seems like you'd think like one or two countries would have like figured this out and maybe like made a different choice along the way. Like, why is there such cohesion of the elite across all of these different places?
That's a good question. I think we underestimate sometimes, as a positivist historians, we underestimate the power of narratives. And narratives are very global. I mean, the cultural projection that the US in particular, but in general the West, has had over the past decades is very important, so much so that in the end, when you do a job like mine, you travel through universities, people in universities think very much alike, whether you go into Delhi or Sydney or New York or Buenos Aires. So the cultural elites of the world are extremely connected. They come from similar social and as I said, narratives background. We read the same books. We watch the same movies. And this to a level also applies to the general population. We've seen now, for example, the rise of this Gen Z revolutions. They're all a bit different from each other in Nepal or in Bangladesh or now in Madagascar, but they have elements of commonality that surely are coming from the fact that this our society that in today's world, they're very connected from a media point of view. In addition to this, I think we should remember that there are big demographic aspects that are common to some of these countries that you mentioned. You know, Hungary is a small country in Central Europe. The United States is a large country on the other side of the pond. But, you know, they both face an issue with the integration of large waves of immigrants that they perceive, or at least somebody in those countries perceive as placing a threat on the cultural identity of these countries. And so this kind of rhetorical message can win. And in the end, you know, in the past, we've seen similar things. The waves of democratizations have been, you know, people talk about the first, the second, the third wave of democratization were global phenomena. The rise of fascism was largely a global phenomenon affecting countries as different as Italy, Germany, and Japan, if you want, even if in slightly different ways. Communism, of course, the rise of socialism was an incredibly international and global phenomenon. And, you know, we talked about before about Argentina and Peronism. You know, there are similarities, of course, between, you know, Peronism and fascism and socialism and maybe many social democratic movements of the 1920s and 30s that, you know, maybe we perceive them as neither because they were more successful in Western Europe after the war. But obviously they had similar fundamental narratives. Right, that that the liberal institutions that we have are actually serving only the wealth owners. We need to, you know, expand the ability of the government. Roosevelt in the United States, right? So these are global phenomena. So today the world is even more interconnected than it was then. It took days for a letter to arrive to Argentina. From Europe, right? And now it takes a second or less. I'm talking to you from, well, I don't know how many, but probably more than 10,000 miles of distance live. So if cultural and political phenomena could be global 100 years ago, I don't see why they shouldn't be global now. And you know, there are other aspects. You can see that there is this preoccupation with demographics, right? We're not making enough children. And in some contexts, it becomes a nationalistic, cultural, ethnocentric, racial thing that definitely in the rhetoric of Orban supporters is often is. Sometimes in the US, Elon Musk seems to have this fixation that we have to make more white children, I don't know, or maybe Christian children. I have no exact idea what is their idea, but you say that some of these problems are common to all of the West. And in fact, they're becoming common even in much of the, developing world, aside from sub-Saharan Africa, right? The number of births are falling very, very fast across the world. So maybe this, again, surprising all the demographers, right? They didn't predict the fall of birth rates so fast. Why? Because there are social narratives that travel much faster than purely how many dollars a year your income is. So again, I don't know if they're so different. Maybe they're not that different.
No, it's funny, even in this conversation, I mean, you and I have never met. You're in Australia, I'm in the United States, and yet very many of the things that you've referenced are things that I've been reading and thinking about and working on too. And I'm not even an academic, like, you know, so there's a level to which the globalization has makes us more similar than I think that we appreciate at times. I mean, like, one thing, though, is I wonder if your theory implicates the ability for government to do very big or complicated social programs at all, because something that's inherent to you can't really do direct democracy universal healthcare. Like, that's just like, you can't do direct democracy building a high-speed rail line. Like, it absolutely has to be, like, and especially things that are continuous, like a social welfare program, or done over a long period of time, like a massive infrastructure project. There is like a point in time in which there's a democratic input, like we vote for people and then the Affordable Care Act might get passed or doesn't get passed or whatever. And then its implementation is the result of millions of choices made by unelected bureaucrats on various levels of government across the entirety of the United States. I mean, in some ways, it sounds like you are saying that we need to be very careful with the implementation of very complex programs that are outside the realm of democratic participation.
Yes, but we can. I'm not saying we can't. We can. But there are conditions. You asked at the beginning about traps. One of the papers that we have is called Bad Democracy Traps. And this paper is exactly about when should we expect democracy to be able to carry out what we call ambitious agendas. But it's exactly what you're talking about. Things that look into the future are risky, are hard to understand. It's hard for the voters to monitor that you are not just fundamentally just taking all that budget and running a little ivory tower for you and your friends, right? Mm-hmm. When can you do that? You can do it if you have sufficient trust, if the culture, the political culture, is one whereby voters have the belief that they can monitor what politics does. They have the belief that most politicians and technocrats are taking into account their preference, their needs. And so you see that the solution must be building that trust. If we want democracy to flourish, we need, as you said, we need those technocrats to do their job. But if all their technocrats are coming from Yale and Harvard, and all the voters are coming from a completely different background, it's going to be hard for these technocrats to be representative. And this is, it's funny because on the left, this is very clear about some representation, right? We want that some minorities are represented in technocratic decision making. We think it's important that they understand certain backgrounds, that maybe a white 50 years old man graduated from Harvard would just not be able to understand it. But then we forget, again, forgive me my use of the term forget. What I mean by forget is we don't take sufficiently into account, even if we were asked directly, we would know that it's true. We don't take sufficiently into account that I have built bureaucracies that are not representative of some of the values, some of the feelings, some of the fears that a lot of our fellow citizens have. And so if we want to build a democracy that works, we need to build a democracy in which voters can trust that the elite is taking into account these preferences. They have sufficient trust in the institutions. How to increase the trust in the institution is to make this elite look more like them. There is one thing that Trump clearly took from Berlusconi. I have no doubt about this. And it is to speak, since even including things that, think about the famous locker room banter, to say things in a way that a lot of Americans feel, this is the way I speak when I'm not seen by the elite and I don't need to be ashamed. This guy has something similar to me. Even if he's rich, even if he's very different than my background, but he's similar to me. He speaks the same. He watches a basketball game the same way I watch it. Mm-hmm. Berlusconi was clearly doing the same. He was saying things that were very embarrassing for me and you, but not embarrassing for a lot of Italians. They were exactly what they say when their home door is closed, right? So if we want a democracy to work well, we need to have that the elites that govern policy making are somewhat representative of society at large, at least to the level that they can be trusted to take into account the preferences of everybody, let's say, the preferences of various groups of society, and not just what in universities we teach that the benefit is greater than the cost.
This is the way to make this the least popular framing is DEI for conservatives, which I'm sure everyone will like. Well, I could talk to you about this forever. This has been a fantastic conversation, but I want to go to our last and final question, which is, what is an argument that you have come across recently, whether it's a book, a movie, a piece of advice, an article, an essay, that you thought was a terrible argument?
I think you will have to edit me thinking about it a bit.
No, it's fine. Take your time.
I'm not I honestly, this, you probably will edit it out. I hope so. But I got this email and I was in the metro here in Sydney and I just took a screenshot of your email and sent it to my wife over WhatsApp saying, what do I hate? And she said, honestly, you don't hate a lot of arguments. So
that's probably a good trait.
But there was, when you were speaking before, there was something that came to my mind that could have been maybe an answer of an argument that I find. Not that you said it, but that you inspired argument that I heard. But I've forgotten in the meantime. Yeah, I forgot about that. I don't know. A lot of what we've been talking about.
Is there not even a book
you've read that you didn't like? No, I'm a very nice guy.
You're the first person on our show who can't come up with one. I've only been having haters come on my show, clearly.
I think it was, I don't know how to say it in English, Terentius, I believe, is the way you say it in English. His name is this play writer. I'm talking about first century before Christ or something like that. So,
okay.
That has this famous say that... I'm a human, and so whatever is human is not alien to me. So I don't hate the arguments of other people. I sometimes think that they are incomplete, but I try to learn from them. But one thing I like to maybe remark, we've been talking a lot about theories in this discussion. And a lot of the time, when you talk to people outside the specific field, they think that when we're talking about models and theories, we are really like doing weather forecasting. We're trying to build a model that directly predicts exactly what's going to happen tomorrow in a measurable way. And you know, you rightly so have been poking me about my theories, you know, like in this paper, you say this, but what about these other things that happens in the war? In this other paper, you say this. And I think it's important to remember that a lot of, when we're talking about the social sciences, we are very ignorant. And the world is changing in front of us every day. And it's really hard. And the level at which we are, I mean, some things we understand them better. We, of course, understand, you know, financial markets better than we understand how people are going to react to the next new political movement that we never heard before, right? Obviously. But, you know, when thinking about many of these topics, we need to think about these theories and models. The way I think of them, and I sometimes tell my students, is don't think of them as really models in the sense that they're going to predict something, which is what they expect, is what a lot of arguments out there are. Like, is your model testable? Otherwise, it's not good at all. It's useless, right? I'm saying sometimes it's useful anyway, the same way I think of as fables. Yeah, I know it's going to sound stupid, but try to bear with me. What's a fable, right? A fable, a famous Greek fable, whether you heard the fable or not, you will see what I mean, is it Greek or Roman? I think maybe.
Greek.
So maybe it wasn't Greek, but we'll see. But anyway, the fable is that there is this fox that is attracted by this grape, and the grape looks very juicy to the fox. The fox tries to jump for the grape, doesn't manage to reach the grape, and the shame of admitting that she can't jump to the grape makes her say that the grape looks sour. That's why I don't want it. Right? Now, this is a very silly story, has nothing to do with reality. Foxes don't speak, but they also don't care about grapes, to be honest. It has nothing to do with reality, but it tells us something about humanity that it's useful. And so I can tell you, oh, it's just sour grape. And I solved all the problem. I don't need to tell you all my theory about what's happening. I just told you two words. Similarly, you know, the cicada and the ant, you know, we can talk about the importance of intertemporal understanding that tomorrow the winter will come. You know, like all this, I can just say, well, it's just like the cicada and the ant. So the fables allow us to say in two words a very complex thought that is very hard to transmit if we don't have this common baggage, common background of precise information. So a model, a theory allows me to just say in a few words, and I say, this is like that model that we read, that paper that day. And we both read it, and we both saw precisely in mathematically what exactly it meant. And so we are much more able to understand each other's. So maybe one argument that I disagree is that all theories, all models must be aimed at precise, empirically testable predictions. No, some models and some theories should be aimed at providing us with a common language so that it makes easier to think about problems, even if they are not the exact problem that we were trying to talk about.
That was a great one. I feel like in the economics, no, in the, I think in the economics space right now, it's a very I wouldn't say unpopular. It's a minority viewpoint that gets vocalized. There's so much emphasis on, you know, the best models are the ones that can be tested in some way. And so, I find your models very useful as a way of thinking about the world. So thank you so much for explaining them to me.
Thank you.
All right, Gabrielle, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks to you for having me. It was very, very, very interesting, very entertaining. Loved it.